Before we talk about AMD and Threadripper, because I know you want to bring that up, and apparently something about a video card that came out. So, I want to talk about a few things. We spent basically a whole week talking about the malware and the WannaCrypt and all that fun ransomware stuff. In a turn of events today, it was announced that, well, it was reported that the guy that stopped the WannaCrypt outbreak by registering the domain that was found to be the kill switch actually got arrested for some malware. And so I just think that's kind of funny. It doesn't have anything to do with education, but I just kind of think it's a nice, ironic turn of events that the guy that, the malware hero, gets arrested for malware.
Well, I was about to say, obviously, he's into malware if he can decipher the code to find out how to stop the other malware, so it would only make sense that he wrote some of his own.
But apparently there was a bank malware, Thanos or something like that, that he got arrested for his involvement in developing it and distributing it or something. So just kind of interesting. I listened to, there's this new podcast started by Mozilla called IRL, in real life or whatever, because technology is kind of real life now. So, I mean, and they did like a whole episode of the ransomware stuff. It was really good. Veronica Belmont's the actual host of that. And she actually interviewed this guy. And so that was like last week or so. And it's just kind of ironic now that he got arrested too.
Well, maybe he shouldn't have gone on the show.
Maybe so.
I just want to know, did they talk about his haircut? Because it's just awesome.
He does have a pretty good haircut. He's got that fro going on.
It looks like he's been running like 1,000 miles an hour. And it's like whoosh back.
Yeah, pushed back. Another follow-up. I casually mentioned that I would love a Mac subscription plan. And it's almost like Microsoft heard me, and now they have come up with the Surface Plus program, which basically, as you get new cell phones nowadays, you basically 0% finance the phone for a certain number of months or whatever, and after you pay basically half of the contract or whatever, you can actually go trade in your phone, upgrade. The phone kind of wipes off the rest of the amount that you owe, and you just sort of start over with a new financing plan. That's actually how I get my new iPhone every year. It looks like Microsoft is going to start that with the Surface program. And so that's kind of neat that you could get a new Surface every year or every 18 months, depending on the leasing terms that you want to do.
I think that's really cool. I wonder if the schools will get like first dibs on those discounted ones they get returns.
Yeah, and I was wondering if that was maybe the reason why Microsoft was doing this, to try to build up some like refurbished inventory to be able to kind of sell to schools. Because a Surface Book that's 18, 12 months old or whatever, it's still going to be in good condition. The only kind of getcha to this program, though, is if you don't decide to trade in your device, with a cell phone, you still get it for the 0% interest or whatever financing, and you could just continue paying your monthly payment to the rest of your term until you've paid off the whole thing. Well, if you don't trade it in, after the 24 months or whatever, they actually charge you basically a 20% interest on the APR, on the amount that you owe less. And so it's almost like if you don't trade it in, it's not worth the money, I guess. And so I guess it's just a way that Microsoft is trying to push people to upgrade these devices.
Well, you know, I guess it's really not a whole lot different from any other leasing program, unless you're doing a lease-to-buy program.
And it's really true. So I know they got one for businesses. So I wonder if they're going to come up with something like this for education, because obviously the Surface device is way too expensive.
Oh, it's insanely expensive, but maybe they would do something with like the Surface laptop for the education, since it's kind of geared towards education anyway.
Yeah, but they need to bring that price way down.
Well, of course, but and get rid of the fabric.
Yeah, I mean, people don't really seem to like that a whole lot. But people say that this is the MacBook Air that people want. Mm-hmm. But if you actually do some digging or whatever, if you want to spec the, if you take the specs other than the screen, if you look at like everything else besides the screen, to get the Surface laptop specs up to like the low end of the MacBook Air, you got to spend like another $400 or $500. And so, but it's like this, but you get the better screen for the lower price.
Yeah, I was about to say you get touch.
Yeah, but I mean, some people are into touch, some people are not into touch.
But there's a song I could sing here, but I don't think it would follow your iTunes non-explicit.
Oh, well, then we won't do that then. But it's just sort of, I mean, I was really surprised that Microsoft dropped that at an education event, dropped that laptop at $1,000.
It was kind of like they had the event for education, and they turned to the side of the stage. And in other news, here's a laptop, because it had nothing to do with education.
And when the reviews actually came out for that laptop, when reviewers actually got it in their hands or whatever, they said, this is the Surface laptop you want. Just pay the extra $50 and get Windows 10 Pro.
Yeah.
And so apparently Windows 10 S is not something that... But, you know, I could see Windows 10 S not being a consumer-liked... Like non-education, non-business people liking Windows 10 S. It seems like it might be a little too crippled for them, that they would need to get the Pro or just the Home Edition.
Oh, of course. I mean, and right now I think it's free to upgrade right now for the next couple months or whatnot, but then it's still going to be pretty inexpensive.
Yeah, $50 is not bad.
Not at all.
But I just think it's great that Microsoft's coming up with this program, and it gives me hope that maybe Apple will do it, and maybe I can convince my wife to let me do it.
For a Microsoft product?
No, for Apple products. Did I say Microsoft again? I'm sorry.
You did, but I meant Apple. I think secretly you really want to.
Secretly, I want the Surface Studio.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? That's the iMac people need.
That is, I went and saw one of those in a Windows store, which is really funny. I went to a mall, and the Apple store across the walkway is packed full of people. There's like two people in the Microsoft store. There's more employees than customers in the Microsoft store, which is sad because their products are really nice. I mean, they're really pretty. Don't get me wrong. But that Surface Studio, man, that is just, it is gorgeous. And I saw a nice product placement for it in a TV show that I was watching last night, too. Guy threw that little dial on top of that screen and was rotating some stuff.
It's cool. It really is cool. Microsoft's always been big into product placement. I swear there was more Lumia phones in movies than there were in real life. I mean, that's just kind of how they were. But, I think Apple should look at that Surface Studio and look at the fact that how many of their customers are using the Adobe products and how Adobe integrated within that stuff with Microsoft and go, maybe we should do something similar to that. You know, first to market, yeah, Microsoft. Apple's traditionally second to market and more refined. Anyway, so I think it'd be really cool if they kind of made a copy of that. Not a copy, but, you know, threw the Apple spin on it.
What I've heard actually bloggers and podcasters talk about is like a 27-inch iPad-like device. Well, that's running kind of iOS, that's got maybe when iOS continues to evolve and can kind of be more towards a pro and creative user or whatever, that like a big touchscreen iPad device sitting on your desk, not like the ones at Fox News for Shepard Smith has, but
and but honestly, you know. Though, and what I was the next thing I was like right on that same track is Mac OS doesn't really have a lot that it would have to be done to run iOS apps. I mean, the developers wouldn't even have to recompile things. They could do the same kind of Rosetta software that they did when they went from PowerPC to Intel. They could have a Rosetta software that went from Intel to their ARM architectures that would run at the exact same speeds as the iOS products. And that way, this would be like an ultimate developer device, too, for, hey, the developer can slap the screen down on the desk and start testing an iOS device.
That would be really great. I mean, you can kind of get away with that if you run the simulator in Xcode, but that's not really...
Yeah, the simulator stinks. I'm sorry, Apple, it stinks.
It's miserable. I mean, it is really bad, because I fired it one time just because, like, when the new iPhone size came out or whatever, I downloaded it just so I can kind of see if I wanted to go to the plus size or if I wanted to stay at the smaller size, because I wanted to kind of see the screen difference. But it was like, even on a pretty decent machine... the thing was just, it was hammered. I mean, it's just so intensive to open.
Yeah, I got a funny story about the simulator. The day the iPad came out, my wife had one of those HP notebooks that flipped around the screen and snapped down so you could use it as a tablet too. You know, back when they were like 4 inches thick, I think.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Weighed about 10 pounds. Well, I still had I had an iMac then, and I had loaded the... of course, the Xcode and whatnot on there, and had the iOS simulator running on it. Except I was presenting my simulator window in an accelerated VNC session to her HP, which had the same resolution as the iPad, and that's actually what convinced me to go get the iPad using the simulator on a VNC connection, how cool and how easy it was to use.
And then how long did we keep those iPad first generations?
Dude, I had it for a long time.
Mine was gone in 6 months.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't find it that useful, to be completely honest with you.
It was a consumption device. That was about it.
It was very, very consumption.
I really liked it. In fact, I had the first generation signature edition Dodo case with mine too.
Oh, I think I remember that. Isn't that the one that looked like a book?
Yeah, it looked like a book, made bamboo on the edges and had the nice traditional book binding on it.
I mean, I wanted the iPad to be the device, but at that time though, I really wasn't really into like digital movies and stuff like that or digital TV shows, so I was still using a lot of DVDs and watching like traditional TV and stuff. But now that I'm basically everything's digital, this iPad Pro, man, I was telling you before we got on the air that I think I'm going to go get the smart keyboard because I'm actually finding myself using this device more and more, even for tasks that I'm trying to do here at work. Now there's some things that I kind of got to work around to get it to work. And like, if I need to remote into a server, I have to actually remote into another computer to be able to do things. I can't natively manage like Active Directory and stuff on the iPad itself, but checking mail, doing answering email, SSHing into switches and routers and stuff. A lot of that I'm able to do from here, and it's just really convenient because it's a lot easier to carry around than lugging my bag and all my cables and everything ready to go.
So can you do a direct console to a switch from it?
You can. I know you used to, because I know there was a company that made a 30-pin cable that basically could connect to like a USB serial adapter. Oh no, it was like
was
a
30 pin Bluetooth 30, adapter one,
something like that. It was like the 30 pin to a console adapter or something like that. So you could, and they had an app that went along with it to where you could direct console into it. But I think when they went to Lightning, I'm not sure if that company actually made another thing, because I think the last time that I kind of looked it up, I think you had to get the Lightning to 30 pin adapter and then use this to
end up with a dongle 6 inches long.
Yeah, you had to like convert the Lightning to 30 pin and then the 30 pin to the console adapter. I really wish somebody would make another adapter. Now there is a company that actually makes like a Bluetooth version, and I think this actually may be the same company. That may be the route that they went. They actually made a Bluetooth version that you Bluetooth to. I'll have to look this up and see if I can't find it and put it in the show notes, because I think it's like a $100 device. You Bluetooth to it and then you console into it over Bluetooth or whatever.
I remember my Juniper rep had one of those, and it was pretty cool. That was back in 2012, so it's got to still be around. I mean, he used the fire out of it.
That I need to look into that, because that would be great, because the only time I really need to bring a computer to go work on a switch or a piece of network gear is like if I have to console into it because it's having some like major issues or it's lost connectivity.
Oh, cool.
So tell us a little bit about AMD. The article I read said that they could finally take pictures and write about, I guess, press preview kits or whatever they got. And if you look at the Anatech link in the show notes, it is a pretty impressive box that they got.
But you know what? I mean, those boxes, well, not the Pelican case, of course, but the boxes inside of the Pelican, that's actually the retail box.
Yeah, because I got the link to Newegg, too, where you can actually pre-order. It doesn't actually come out where you can actually buy it until, I think, the 10th. But you can actually pre-order it now if you have $1,000 that you don't have anything else to do with.
Hey, but they also have a $549 version, too.
So, I mean, if you're into that sort of thing. But the box looks incredible.
Oh, yeah. The box is just as cool as the name. I think that's AMD's just showing off at that point, I think.
But I think with a $1,000 processor, I mean, you kind of have to. You kind of got to make it like, hey, this is something special. And I think that's kind of what they're trying to attempt to do here.
But we also got to remember, it's $1,000 cheaper than the nearest competitor.
That's true. I mean, so as expensive as it may seem, it's still cheaper than what Intel's got right now.
About to say, we can't forget, Intel has Xeon processors that just the processor alone is $8,000. Now, the AMD Epics of that same proportion are still $4,000. That's a lot of money, but it's still half the cost. And I think that's what they're kind of trying to do. Hey, 30% more performance for half the cost.
I mean, what do you think Intel's answer is going to be to this? Do you think they're going to find some way to drop their price? Or do you think they're just going to continue and hope that, like, their brand recognition, I guess, keeps
them
afloat.
They've already kind of started answering it with the Xeon scalable processors. They've created their own version of Infinity Fabric, which will let them, as they put in their press releases, AMD's gluing dies together. Well, they're going to glue their own dies together.
It's just great. I'm glad to see AMD's back.
I know. It makes me so happy. I don't know how many tears of joy I've shed over the past few weeks.
I mean, you are an AMD fan. I'm really anxious to see when this comes to, like, other than buying Alienware gear. I'm ready to see if, like, when I can get some Optiplex computers or something from Dell to see the prices.
I don't think you'll ever see a Threadripper in Optiplex.
Well, even now, just a Ryzen build.
You'll see it in their more, what was their workstation line called? I got one sitting on my desk.
Precision?
Yeah, that's going to be in the Precisions.
I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing the Ryzens come down. Like, even just the Ryzen 5, or not even necessarily a 7, but...
Man, but the Ryzen 7's $279 now?
I mean, I would love to see the price of those machines come down so that I can get more of them and get more processing power out of them and get longer life.
Yeah, I could keep going on and on and on and on and on, and on about it. I mean, I'm so excited about this whole transition. I mean, it's kind of just the little guy finally got ahead.
But do you think that's kind of really what Intel's kind of banking on, is all these other companies like Dell and Apple with their, like, I wouldn't say licensing, but, like, they're being so dependent. It's like they have these agreements that they buy these bulk processors from them.
Well, I mean, in all honesty, AMD is not really a trusted name in data center computing. I mean, how long has it been since you've seen an Opteron anywhere?
Every server that I've ever put my hands on, I have never seen anything other than an Intel Xeon in it.
Yeah, and there's a reason. I mean, in big business and data center, they like to use trusted companies. Now, I think Epic is gonna flip those tides some, because, oh gosh, what was it, Project 42 or something like that. There's already I got to pull it up now because it's awesome. AMD's already got partnerships with companies where they're releasing single rack, 1 petaflop supercomputers in one rack. It's crazy. I mean, it's a full 42U rack. About 8 U's are taken up by some other stuff, but the rest of it is packed full of Epic CPUs and the new Vega GPUs. And yeah, they're saying you could run an entire company's VDI infrastructure in it and be done with it.
And that's one of the things I actually wanted to look at here at the school, was running some kind of VDI, but I knew that I was going to have to, like, do some major upgrades to my server infrastructure and actually put those GPUs in to be able to run Flash. But Flash will be gone by the time I get ready to probably to do this, so maybe I won't have this problem.
Yeah, maybe we won't even bother with it. But along the virtualization thing, Intel has put out some kind of mud out there about how, well, you can't go to an AMD CPU because you can only migrate between Intel CPUs.
That VMware, what is it? What does VMware call that?
Where the vMotion?
Well, not the moving, but the thing where you have to, like, set up, like, if you have different processors in it, you have to, like, turn something on to be able to make it work between the
two. Yeah, it's just a compatibility mode thing. And what it does is it disables all the extra extensions in the processor.
Yeah, I think you lose a little bit of features and
you do.
Ability. And I think, and also, like, if it will actually lower the performance of all of your processors to the lowest performing processor.
Yeah. But, and also, I mean, in, let's say, in the VMware world, you've never been able to really do it between different generations of Intel processors anyway. But years ago...
Not easily.
No, not easily. But years ago, KVM and Red Hat, they got working live migration between AMD and Intel years ago. So those companies like Amazon, DigitalOcean, Linode, all those massive hosting companies, well, they're not using VMware. They're using KVM already anyway. So those companies could really benefit from these because they could get a 32-core CPU in a 1U box.
Yeah, and just provide more processing power for a lower price for their clients.
Oh, yeah. I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, me too. Cause...
And give some more storage while you're at it. Gosh, yeah. Quit being so chinchy on the storage, people.
I think I got, 20 gigs or something like that for my plan?
It's like, come on!
I know. I was so scared. And so it's like when we were building this podcast and I was building the website and stuff for it and all the RSS feeds and stuff, I was like, do I want to use the hosting on Linode to host the MP3 files, or will we ever get to a point where I'm going to fill up that 20 gig with MP3 files? And so I was like, you know what? I'm just not even going to run the risk. It's like B2 storage from Backblaze is so cheap that yeah. I'm just going to go that route. I was going to do Amazon, but the price of that stuff can sneak up on you real quick.
You know, they have this calculator, and apparently I'm so dumb I can't use the calculator to figure out what it's going to cost.
But so far, I think Backblaze has only charged me like 4 cents for the hosting of our MP3s. So I can't complain too much.
Oh, no, not at all. Last piece of AMD thing that I will talk about, and then we can move on to real news. RX Vega's out. Cue the cheering, add some clapping or whatnot in the editing, but RX Vega's finally out.
And so this is their new graphics stuff?
This is their new graphics processors. It's based on a new GCN architecture that they have. It's not faster than like the 1080 Ti as far as like gaming applications or whatnot, but it is one heck of a compute processor. It is 24 teraflops of computing power. And yeah, and that's coming in at I think they said $599 package for that, but you can get one 20 teraflops of compute power, which is still ridiculous, for $399. So yeah, lots of compute power. So you could do accelerated applications that use OpenCL with these, not just gaming. Anything OpenCL runs on these phenomenally, including coin mining if you're into that thing.
Video editing, stuff like that?
Yeah, video editing. In fact, in the SIGGRAPH event, AMD had barged in uninvited to Red's offices to talk to the president and CEO and just like laid out one of their video cards and said, hey, we got 8K scrubbing working live. He was so impressed, he came to the event and spoke in person 2 days later and gave the head of the Vega division a new Red $50,000 camera.
And Red came out of nowhere. I mean, it's like all of a sudden it's like, hey, there's this company Red that makes these cameras. They're really expensive, but they're super great. And it's
yeah.
Where did they come from?
I don't know. And the guy is super young, the guy that started the company too. So makes me feel really unachieved in my life.
I know. It's like, what are we doing? We're just managing school networks.
Woohoo! No, actually, it's a lot of fun.
Which we are going to talk about some school stuff here.
Yeah, we need to.
We had a news story that I apparently missed, and you did too, because I'm not going to take full responsibility for this. But 2 years ago, I think at TCA, Google was actually there presenting Google Education. I think it was actually still called Google for Education or Google Apps for Education at that time. They've probably changed names like 6 times since then. They're just as bad as Microsoft. But they would come in and they talk about like their Google Console or whatever. But the real thing that they were pushing was this new thing called Google Expeditions. And yeah. So basically what Google Expeditions was you signed up, and if you got accepted by Google or whatever, which of course we all did, but I don't know of anybody that actually got accepted, Google would actually come out. They would bring like a bucket full of Android phones or Android tablets or whatever, and basically do like virtual field trips with VR with Google Cardboard and all these devices or whatever. But it looks like they have released their actual Expedition app that they actually do this stuff with to the public. And
that's
so
cool.
Now you don't have to necessarily rely on actually Google coming out to do this. So if you have the ability to do a bunch of Android devices and arriving soon on iOS, you will be able to do these virtual field trips with the Google Expeditions. And Google is one of those companies that actually care about education. So, I mean, and I actually have a Google Cardboard device, and I mean, for a piece of paper, essentially, I mean, it is a pretty cool little VR device or whatever. I used an app that was basically the SpaceX rocket landing on the barge. And so you can kind of like watch it as it comes down or whatever. It's just really cool how that works. We've talked about how I'm not so much of a fan of VR because I like to kind of still know what's going on around me. And it kind of make me a little bit nauseous, I think, if I was like just so totally immersed in this environment or whatever. So, but I can really see the benefits of VR being brought to schools for like these virtual field trips or whatever, because you can go see these different things as if you were basically actually there without actually having to spend too much money to actually go.
Oh, I know. And it's leaps and bounds better than the virtual field trips of the past where you had the little 32-inch television in the front of the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're looking around as if you were standing in the parking lot at these different places or whatever. Like, the screen I'm looking at, or on the intro video, the kind of, like, still image or whatever is at the Colosseum in Italy or whatever. And so, I mean, even not even just for school use. I mean, I think when this app actually comes to iOS, I think I'm going to try it out just to try to see it, because, I mean, it's kind of cool. I'd love to be able, like, when my kid gets a little bit older, to kind of show him these things, because
yeah,
we probably won't ever have the ability to take all these trips overseas to see all these crazy landmarks, or not crazy, but I'll see all these great landmarks or whatever, even though I'd love to be able to take them.
Well, one of the things that I really appreciate Google with this new Expeditions VR experience is they've released it on both the Daydream and the Cardboard platforms. I really appreciate that, because Cardboard is their legacy platform now that a lot of things still run on, and Daydream is only is supported on newer hardware. So it's really looking out for education by releasing it to those Cardboard devices, because there was no certification process to have a Cardboard device, and there is for Daydream.
Well, with the Cardboard device, at least the one that I have, there's really nothing to it. I mean, the app or whatever is built so that if, like, you tap the center of the screen, that's kind of what you do. And so mm-hmm. the Cardboard has, like, a button that moves this little flap up against the screen that has, yeah, like a
little magnet on it.
Yeah, to basically can register a touch on the screen. And so there's nothing. There's no pairing with Bluetooth, nothing. Yep. And so it was a very simple, great device, easy to get into doing mm-hmm. some VR. And I'm assuming those $12 ones that you see at Walmart or whatever are essentially the same things.
They are.
And so if you don't want to go the Cardboard route, because even Cardboards can get to, I think I paid like $20 for mine because I didn't want to, I just bought one on Amazon because I got super excited when I saw it at TCEA or whatever. So I was like, well, I'm going to have one waiting for me at the house. But schools can pick up these $10 or $12 devices from these different companies or whatever and get the same function as the Cardboard or whatever. Or they could get the kits and build their own Cardboards, which could be a project in itself in the classroom.
Or they could even 3D print one.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if you have those sorts of things. But so I'm really anxious to try this Expeditions app, and I'm going to see if, like, maybe that's something that we can kind of integrate. We do this kind of like a bring your own device kind of program with our student wireless or whatever. So students do have their phones, and if the app is free, there's no reason that there's nothing stopping them from hopping on the store real quick and getting it, because they've done the Google Classrooms app and stuff like that. But in similar news, a month or so ago, maybe longer, Google Earth actually came up with an update for Android and the web, which did some new features like Voyager and stuff like that. And it looks like that has finally come to the iOS app. And so they kind of tout it as like planning your next adventure with Google Earth or whatever. But the cool things that I like that I think might be useful is, like, you can search for location, and they got these things called knowledge cards that come up. And so you can like look for an information, and all of a sudden, like in the instance, the image that they're given in the little GIF down there, like they look for Tokyo, and all in this information in this card on Tokyo kind of comes up, and they show like a bunch of different images or whatever. And so that might be really useful in like a geography class or something like that, or a history class.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. So, like, say you went and pulled up the Golden Gate Bridge, you could see, well, so many miles of cable are on there. And it's really interesting, some of the information that comes up on there.
I mean, I think it's great. I could see that being a useful product in a classroom. Especially because, I mean, we talked about before that Google Earth is free, and so why not use it? For our topic today, actually came up with a fellow tech director sent us an email yesterday, I believe. Asking about account management. And so that's kind of what I wanted to do today, was kind of talk about how we manage accounts, what we use for account management, and just, like, I wouldn't necessarily say what we're doing is best practice, especially what I'm doing may not necessarily be best practice. Yours is probably more best practice than what I'm doing. But I want to kind of talk about, like, the things that you do, because you do a little bit more than I do, as far as, like, making account management easier on you to manage the account management, kind of like an Inception thing going on there.
Woohoo.
So the email that we got was basically saying that every year, this tech director basically kind of started over completely with his student accounts, which I would say don't even do that.
It's a way to do it.
It's a way to do it. Not necessarily the, if I look at it this way, every time you create an account logs into a computer, makes a profile, you delete that account, you make that same account again, that account makes a different SID or GUID or whatever special number that Microsoft gives them in Active Directory. That logs into computer, it makes another profile. And so you're going to be filling up your hard drive with all these profile folders if you don't image your machines every year or run something like Deep Freeze. Or there's another trick, which it's kind of hacky, but I've done it before in a school district that was a little bit conscientious about disk space, especially when they had like 40, 60, 80 gig hard drives in it. You drop all your students in the domain guest account, and their profiles don't stay on the computer whenever they log off. They automatically get deleted. And so as long as you're teaching your users to store in Google Drive or their home directory, which maps is in my computer, they can log in all day long, and their profiles don't stay as long as they're a domain guest. And so that's kind of a cheat way to do that, not necessarily recommended, because the one thing I have noticed with Windows 10 is it takes about 2 times as long for an initial login whenever account logs in, depending on the type of hard drive it is. Now, if it's an SSD, it's actually faster than Windows 7 or whatever, but with a traditional spinning hard drive, I actually find the process of the initial login on Windows 10 a little bit slower than the Windows 7.
At least they give you nice little clever things to read and change the color every now and then, and are real polite about, we're still getting it ready.
But once they do it one time, it's okay. I mean, so they'll get over it.
Yeah, but I guess if you were using that guest mode, that would be every time.
Yes, and so that's kind of the thing that I wouldn't necessarily recommend unless you're running like all SSDs in your environment.
Yeah, and folder redirection and some other stuff. Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't be bad then.
I mean, I'm getting there with all SSDs, and so maybe sometime in the future this could be a possibility, but right now I can't turn that on because... No, it'd take...
I get it.
They would complain.
Yeah, they would. And some of us do some really odd things. Like today I deployed an Optiplex 745 to a location. I don't even remember the year that thing was made. It's so old.
Yeah, that is... Yeah.
Needless to say, it does not have an SSD in it.
No, but what's crazy is it'll run Windows 10.
It will. It's not, but it will.
It may not run it well, but it will. We're both using Active Directory. What are you using to manage your accounts? And I believe at one point you told me you're actually syncing the Active Directory with your Google account directory.
Oh, yeah. I'm using the Google tool, Google Directory Sync. And I sync everything from groups to users and mailing lists and everything. So all of my mailing list and my groups and whatnot are managed from Active Directory, and Google just gets a copy of that. So I don't ever double create anything.
Now, and this gives you the ability, like if a student has to have their password reset in Active Directory, it basically resets the Google account to be the same password. Is that correct?
Well, that is a separate utility we are using it too. It's called Google Password Syncing. And what it does, it's a utility that has to be installed on every domain controller in the environment. And it basically intercepts the password reset, the password changes, whatnot, to the directory, and submits them up to Google and then pushes them back to the directory, because once they're in the directory, they're encrypted and Google wouldn't know what they were.
Oh, I got you. Is there any kind of like lag time between that happening, or is it pretty much real time?
Instantaneous.
Oh, so that's good. Well, depending on internet connection, obviously.
Oh, of course. And I haven't had the first bit of problems with the password syncing, unless, of course, the account that you're binding to the directory and to Google change the password and you don't do it here. Those kind of things.
I got you. So it's kind of dependent. It has to run as a certain user, I guess, to connect to the Google.
Yeah. And I do use service accounts for that. So I've created some Google accounts that... I won't give you what the name of it is because I don't want someone hammering on it and locking the account, but it's an account that's granted access to manage our domain and our Google domain. And yeah, it has lots of rights. So we use it so it doesn't ever run into issues about it can't read this user property or whatnot.
I use service accounts too. I have like an administrator account for like Google. There's some other accounts that I have specifically for Google, like as far as managing our backups and different things. And as far as domain accounts, I have like the antivirus has its own account, the VMware has its own account, SQL has its own account. And so I try not to use my account for stuff case like I was to ever leave, things won't break if they disabled my account, things like that. So,
no, of course. And you would hate for your account to someone to keep hammering on your account and actually lock your account and then break the rest of the services you got.
So what is your password policy when it comes towards students?
Well, actually, I take the policy of Google because that's what we're using. So it's not a very stringent policy, but it is the requirements for password syncing to work. And I know it's not long enough. And I lie to them and tell them 8. But it's actually the Google password requirements are 6 characters or more with an uppercase and a number. They don't even require a special character. So those are the policies that I've put in as far as Active Directory requirements, and along with my self-service portal, the requirements in there. Those are what it requires before it'll let you change the password.
So what do you use for the self-service portal?
It's a product called PWM. It's an open source Java application, and it works on any directory structure, including Active Directory. It'll work on eDirectory from Novell and, of course, 389 and Open LDAP and all those other things. And basically what it does is it gives a place where users can go in and register secret questions. And so those secret questions are tied to their account in the directory. So if they've forgotten their password, they can go to this website and say, hey, I forgot my password, answer the questions, and they can reset their password. And also what it lets them do if they're on a Chromebook and they want to change their password. Well, password syncing with Google is one direction for Windows up. It can't go from Google down. So this would allow them to do password changes on a Chrome device that would also change their domain password locally.
Oh, that makes sense. And have you always been using something like this or a self-service portal, or have you done something else to manage passwords or whatever?
Well, I didn't really start using the self-service portal for anything until I started working at the university, and we had one. And so when I started out here at school I'm at, I wanted a similar function because of how well it worked and research and whatnot, and found this open source project, and it works really well. It does have some other added benefits. It lets you see things like how many times the users tried to log in incorrectly. It lets you see things like when was the last time they changed their password. It doesn't let you see their password, but it does let you get like a gauge of complexity of the password that they used last time. And one of the biggest reasons that I deployed it out, though, to our staff before our students is we have some tech liaisons here, and I didn't really want to mess it around in the Active Directory Users and Groups console. And this little package has an help desk function to where you can grant people the ability to reset other people's passwords and change user information all from within this web UI without directly going into users and groups where they could do potentially more damage.
Okay, that makes total sense. Have you had any problems with students trying to get other students' passwords reset? Like a student trying to reset another student's password by trying to answer the questions or what?
Not yet, but I'm sure we're going to. It's just kind of one of those things that's going to happen. We do teach the importance of having good questions, not like, where do I live? Well, of course, we all know you live here.
Okay, so they can put in their own questions. They're not giving you like a no.
They have a list of 20 that I've put in there, and that's also part of those good questions. Some of them were, where do I live? Those kind of things.
What street I grew up on?
Of course. And you can remove questions. You can change the questions. You can even offer different questions in different languages here. So it's really cool.
Okay, so these are questions like they're still given a choice. There's given a choice of questions, but you write the questions so they can be a little bit more granular. Like, what is your second cousin's third wife's middle name?
Twice removed.
Yeah, twice removed middle name. It's crazy stuff that like nobody would know.
Yes. Or 8 minutes and 13 seconds, what happens in the Matrix?
Yeah.
I mean, those kind of things.
That's a good one. I like that. And it's Neo probably says, whoa. It's probably what happens at that point.
Dude!
Whoa.
He invokes his Bill and Ted days.
Yeah. So that's really good. We kind of take the complete opposite approach when it comes to passwords or whatever. I don't know the underlying reason why we do it this way, But I guess this is the way my my supervisor and I guess her predecessor or whatever has wanted to do it. But we are in the ball camp that we set student accounts passwords, we set their Google account passwords, and we do not allow them to change them.
Well, you're not alone in that. A lot of people around our area do that. A school north of me does it. A school south of me does it, like that. So it's not uncommon. In fact, when I started in Buena, that's how it was. Passwords were written down in a book, and everybody, the IT administration, knew what everyone's password was. So when they forgot, they just said, "Oh, it's this on the phone." And I just really didn't like that approach. I didn't like the liability it puts on the IT staff. A student could go, "Well, I didn't do that."
Yeah.
Because someone else logged in.
We actually had an instance of that actually come up. It wasn't that a student used a student's user account to log in. It was a student walked away from a Chromebook that it was still logged in.
Yeah.
And so I've had to actually look at some logout inactivity policies to see if I can't set that up or whatever, because you can't just leave a Chromebook open all day long sitting on a desk and don't think somebody's going to mess with it.
Oh, of course they are.
But just FYI, don't print anything from a Google account on the school's network to the school's printer that you don't want found out who actually did it. So,
yeah, and actually, I do print logging on our Windows print servers, too.
We actually do now, too, with this new Papercut software we have, but that's for another conversation. But I'm glad to hear that I'm not alone in the password management. Now, I know that it's not right. It's probably best to click the little checkbox that says force user to change password on first login, stuff like that. I know that that's probably the better way to do it. But I think probably if I was to venture to guess why we do it the way we do it, we have some teachers that basically have basic all access, full access to all student information, data, everything stored on the servers and stuff like that. And so these teachers are the ones that actually get these lists of student accounts that we kind of keep, and we keep it in a Google spreadsheet. It's not an actual physical paper like you had, but we have it in an actual Google spreadsheet. But I think that they like having access to these students' information. And I'm not going to lie, it has come in handy, especially like when dealing with some issues like, hey, this student's getting blocked on this website for this or whatever, that I can actually go in and log in as that student and be able to see what's going on. So, I mean, it has its advantages, but it's not something – it's something that I want to look at actually changing in the future. I don't really want to keep doing it this way. I don't want to be a password manager. Because, I mean, it's no secret what the scheme is. I mean,
I'm going to venture to guess that it has something to do with a lunch number.
I can neither confirm nor deny that is the case.
And here's why I say that. Because that's what every one of them I've ever ran into at a school have done. Because they keep the same policy all the way down through elementary up to high school. And, well, elementary kids are going to have a hard time remembering things. So they go a really, really easy schema.
Yes, and that's essentially, like I said, I can neither confirm nor deny, but I will say that it has been a recent change to move, if we were to be using lunch numbers, it was a recent move. We have moved from another number that everybody is assigned, not necessarily from a school, but we...
I'm not even going to answer. I'm not even going to guess what that is because I know.
But I think this may be the last year that anybody should have that password. So, I mean,
that's cool.
So we will finally be done with that number. It wasn't the full number. It was a few, but it wasn't the full number. So, I mean, completely.
Probably the last four of that said number.
Again, can neither confirm nor deny.
Yeah. you worked at the service center with me. Things we've ran across places.
I mean, and so I want to do things different. And I got the link in the email that you responded to the guy. And so I'm going to kind of look into that and maybe in a year or so, maybe kind of approach this idea of like loosening. I mean, letting people. Here's the problem. A lot of our people have a habit of forgetting their passwords.
Yeah.
I mean, and so. If we do this route, there's got to be something in place that they can change their password.
But here's what I've discovered over the years. People used to forget their passwords here a lot, too. But it wasn't because they couldn't remember one. It was because they didn't get to pick the one they were remembering.
You know, that could be a... Well, I mean, we have people that forget their passwords from the one that we set, and it's a, and like you said, it may or may not be a number that they have to remember anyway.
Yeah.
And so they forget that. I mean, they forget. I mean, the password is essentially may or may not be a number that they have to remember, plus letters that may or may not be in their full name. So, I mean,
it's things that you shouldn't forget.
How do you forget that kind of stuff?
You're right. And but I can guarantee at least half of our staff, the password's probably the same password that they use on Facebook. Because when someone goes, oh, I can't think of one, I can't ever remember one, I always say, well, what do you use for Facebook? You remember that one.
That actually brings up another point that I kind of want to talk about, and then we'll kind of wrap this up. You sync your passwords between Google and Active Directory.
Correct.
We do not. Our Active Directory wasn't set up to be able to do that. I am slowly getting it to where... getting people's email addresses put into Active Directory so that if I choose to do that route in the future that I can do that. So I'm actually doing every new account that gets made from like last year on has their email account in it. In fact, all staff emails were actually put in last year whenever we got the new copy machine management software because it had to do with some email stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool. Just kind of a side tangent. Like they can all do scan to email and they don't have to actually type in their email address because it pulls into the authentication software that the copiers are using and you just hit the me button and it just sends it to whatever email is in the authentication service. And so that's why I was able to put the email addresses in the account. And so those have all been done. So now it's just kind of basically student accounts. And so basically from here on out, and as I think about it, and I know I could do a lot of stuff with PowerShell scripts or whatever, but there's, since you're dealing with 1400, 1500 accounts, there's a strong possibility that you might have two accounts with the same name. And so I'm trying to come up with an easy way to avoid any issues there.
Well, I've gotten some scripts that I'm going to have to pull them back up that I wrote for another district. That actually did some checks for that. Like, if this user already exists, do this. If this user already exists, do this. So I do have some solutions that we could offer the listeners for those kind of problems. And maybe you'd be interested to see what the code looked like anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely check that out. But so the point I was trying to get at, how much do you sync accounts? How much, as far as, I guess, the million-dollar term, I guess, is single sign-on. How do you handle single sign-on stuff in your district?
Well, this year I'm going to be testing a product. The gentleman that emailed us actually suggested this one to me. I'm drawing a blank.
Was it that Clever app?
Yes, Clever. Clever. I've actually got everything set up to start doing single sign-on with Clever. So, but we got to remember, single sign-on and password syncing are not the same thing.
This is just basically syncing the accounts with those other services, not necessarily syncing the passwords with those other services.
Yeah, I mean, single sign-on is more when you're using like a SAML service to authenticate somewhere else, to push it here and say, this guy's already authenticated here, go ahead and trust him.
Okay.
That's kind of how single sign-on works.
Okay.
Where password syncing is kind of more brute force.
I got you. Okay, so single sign-on, that's great. So basically, I guess my question is, besides Google or in Active Directory, do you do any other password syncing besides those two services? And how do you kind of feel about that? Do you think it's a good thing for their domain accounts? No, we do it for simplicity's sake. I mean, truthfully,
yes.
That's why we do it.
Yes.
I don't do it at all. I mean, I don't even do really single sign-on anywhere. The only single sign-on I have is my domain account can log into my VMware. I mean, that's essentially the only single, and they kind of force you to do that in a way. It's part of the setup process, but we try to, we have people have separate accounts for different things. So in a lot of instances, teachers' domain accounts are not the same password as their Google account. And to me, I'm kind of the security minded. I think that's a better idea personally. But I know we do a lot of things for simplicity's sake.
Of course. And, like I was saying before, those passwords are encrypted in both places. The only time that it's seen unencrypted is through that application that's installed on the domain controllers. And it's only in active memory. It's never sent in the clear text anywhere. Now, they have an option in the Google directory sync where if you wanted to store your passwords unencrypted in the directory, it can do password syncing directly through that tool, but I would never recommend that to anyone. That's insanity.
That's not something that... Always encrypt those passwords as best you can. And the good thing about the domain controllers is nobody's going to get on the domain controllers except for you, and so nobody's really going to see those things. And it's not like you...
And then again, it's running in RAM. I would have to, like, dump the RAM to get it. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's probably like it writes it, and then it gets overwritten, and so it's just automatically gone. And so,
yeah. So. It's one of those crazy attacks you'd see, like, on NCIS or something.
What about that CSI Cyber Show? Would we see it there?
Oh, goodness. Well, they're just going to make up stuff like the Infinity Zoom, enhance.
Yeah, no video does that. I mean, come on.
I'm sorry. The camera's recording in 360p, and they've zoomed in to two squares, and it looks like it's in 4K.
Yeah, that's not happening. There's
enhance.
No. You know, that's not. Well, I mean, so I guess you responded to the email. I kind of told him what we did because going back to the email, he was saying, like, do we delete accounts every year? I don't. Do you?
I do not. And in fact, I don't clear home directories or anything. From the time the user's created to the time they leave, everything's persistent. So if a kid starts in kindergarten and graduates, they have all their stuff from then on out.
I kind of have that same feeling as far as when it comes to home directory stuff, but it is asked of us to clear home directories because apparently they are concerned as far as sharing work, I think, is the main concern.
It's just as easy to share a piece of paper in my point of view.
And really, truthfully, we've run into the same thing with Google Drive because there's, other than deleting the account, there's no way to delete the contents of the Google Drive account that I know of, other than deleting the account.
You know, I don't. Can you do some of that stuff through the eDiscovery tool?
I don't know. We might have.
I know you can look at everything in the Drive account, but
I wonder if you could delete it, because I know that then Vault's got it and Vault keeps it whether it's deleted or not, from what I understand. So I mean, I don't really know. So I mean, and it's easier to share in Google Drive than it is to share.
I was about to say you got their password. You can just log in and go wham.
Yeah, I can just log. But I'm not doing that for 1,400 students. Are you kidding me? I'm kind of in the same boat. I would like it to be persistent. And in fact, last year I actually forgot to clear the home directories. And so they actually had their stuff from the year before. But yeah, we don't delete accounts either. We disable them. And we just leave them in there until, I guess, that class graduates. And then they'll get deleted because I don't know how your school is or not, but we have a habit of people coming and going. And so a kid can be here for 1 year, and then he'll be gone for two, and then he'll all of a sudden come back. And so we have that kind of an issue going on. We have that with staff, too. So we really don't delete any accounts. They just sort of just stay disabled until...
Well, and I try to be lenient on the students. So, like, this past graduating class, I haven't deleted their accounts yet. And I'll let them sit there for a few more months, and I'll probably get rid of them in December, because if there is something where they've communicated with the college or whatnot using our addresses, because we opened some of those communications up for our high school users, I want them to be able to go back and get that if they haven't yet.
Yeah.
I try to be nice.
We actually hang on to everything for a full year. Their accounts will be disabled. But they can easily call up to the district or whatever, and we can enable access and be able to get them anything that they need out of it, except for home directories this year, because home directories got wiped out, which was kind of handy for me because I needed to move the home directories anyway. So I just made new ones. But as far as their accounts go, we hang on to everything for a year before it gets deleted from our servers or our Google accounts. So there's a lot of things that we do that are similar, a lot of things that you do that I wish I did, and so I need to actually start looking into those things and maybe try to start convincing the upper administration to maybe, hey, maybe this is something we need to do.
So what's good about that self-service product is you can completely implement it without affecting anything currently, so you can gain that insight without affecting the users.
I might look into doing something like that, because we do allow teachers to kind of manage their own passwords as far as their domains and stuff. And so I may kind of implement that and kind of like let the teachers, hey, if you need to reset your password or whatever, you can go to this website. Even if you can't log into a computer here, you can hit it from the web or whatever and kind of log in or whatever. But I don't know if I should open that up to the public, to the web or whatever.
And I do not have it open publicly.
That might cause some issues.
Yeah, I don't want bots on the internet hitting this thing. So, yeah. No, it's internal only.
So they have to go to somebody else's computer to log in if they can't log in and
correct
get in.
They could use, hey, they can go, hey, okay, I'm good now.
Yeah, just go log in real quick. But up until the portal, what did you do? Just kind of relied on Control-Alt-Delete, reset password?
Yes, and they still can do that, and it still resets just fine.
And that, too, will reset everything across the board?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So there's multiple ways to do it. The portal is more of, I just flat out forgot my password and I can't get in.
Yeah. So essentially, our advice to this guy was don't delete accounts. Just disable them if you need to disable them and keep the files if you want to keep the file. Delete the files if that's your school policy or however you want to handle that. That's sort of like at the mercy of your administration, whatever they want to do. Or if you're the guy that or gal that makes those decisions, that's your choice on how you want to handle that. But and I guess account management, I guess that's kind of up to the district as well as far as how you want to handle it. I mean, there's multiple ways to handle it. I mean, there's a more right way than there are. I mean, I don't want to say there's wrong way to do it, but there's a more right way to do it than...
Well, we'll say more robust ways you can handle it.
Yeah. I mean, you could do from the simple, you manage all the passwords one time and don't click the box that tells them to check it and unchecks the box that allows them to check it or change it. Or you can just, like, as if it was any other service on the internet, just kind of give them free reign to do whatever they want for their passwords or whatever. So, I mean, there's, I guess you kind of look at, like always, you just look at what your needs are. I mean, if you have the need that you have to have, that people need to get into these student accounts on a regular basis, which I think we do for some reason, I guess it's just the way that these people have always done business or taught. That's how they do it. But so, I mean, you just kind of get a look at what's best for your district, but definitely don't delete the accounts. Just disable them if you need to need to delete them, disable them because you don't want
to see if you really do in another month.
Yeah. Because you don't want to fill up your computers with profile folders and all that mess. I mean, you may not store anything on the computers, but the internet is. And so, and that space will fill up pretty quick if you don't have something in place to kind of clean those stuff up. But that's our show this week. We just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about account management, and kind of what we do and in my case, what I should be doing. But if you have any questions, probably more towards Chris, cause he's actually doing things the more right way. He can be found on Twitter at Feeks, and I am at Twist of Matt. And I can direct you to Chris if you need to, or you can contact our show account at Educating Tech. Send us an email at educatingtech@gmail.com. And for more episodes or show notes, you can visit educatingtech.net, and you will also find links to subscribe and to have our podcast delivered by RSS or any app that you want to subscribe to us to. But that's our show, and we'll see you next week. See you later, Chris.
See you later, Matt.